It's 1 o'clock Urbana, time to jump. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Today we're going to be talking with the editor of one of the great publications in American history, The Nation magazine, a frequent guest in our show, and someone conversant in virtually every important topic before The Nation today. Our guest, Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Media giant Comcast showed a fundamental misunderstanding of free speech last week when it tried to squelch an organization that criticized its political work. But its efforts to stifle a small critic created a bigger problem. Real Girls, a media justice organization based in Seattle, tweeted a message signaling their concern over Comcast's hiring of an FCC commissioner who approved the controversial Comcast-NBC Universal merger just 4 months ago. The problem with this social media strategy? Comcast funds Real Girls, and the media giant seems to be squelching any hint of anti-Comcast messages, even a tweet from an organization with less than 3,000 followers on Twitter. Comcast promptly killed an $18,000 grant that funds Real Girls' summer filmmaking program for young women. Lila Katayev is the technical director for Real Girls.
It really was not a question of, should we not speak out about this issue because of a funder? That did not come up. We felt a right to say things that people needed to hear about these issues, and that it was, in fact, something we needed to do.
Katayev said they were worried when they received the email from Comcast, in part for their own financial situation. But more to the point, she said Comcast's reaction underscores the bigger problems with concentrations of power in general and how the company can stifle free speech so easily.
It's this type of public debate, the tweet that we put out there, that we feel like is threatened to be squelched by mergers like this, and really give these large media corporations the power to decide which opinions will see the light of day. That's not a power we were willing to give up.
Within hours of the now infamous tweet and Comcast's reaction, allied organizations rallied around Real Girls and the media jumped on the story. Comcast backtracked and said it would reinstate the funding, but Real Girls declined. Instead, groups like Free Press, the Center for Media Justice, and Magnet helped organize a national fund drive, raising over $14,000 from more than 400 donors in just one day. Katayev says the public support has energized the students participating in Real Girls trainings.
It's really been a teachable moment, too. You know, we're modeling the importance of speaking out to our students, and they're being able to see firsthand how free speech and media consolidation issues affect all of us. And those students are speaking about media justice issues in a way that they never have before. I mean, they're excited, they're fired up, and they're ready to do more.
For more information, visit realgirls.org.
In North Carolina, a new law severely restricts the ability of communities to build their own broadband networks. Pushed through the North Carolina legislature by internet providers Time Warner and CenturyLink, the bill allows existing community networks to continue, but makes it illegal for them to expand into new territory. Brian Bowman is the public affairs manager for the city of Wilson, North Carolina. Wilson has a successful fiber optic network called Greenlight, which now serves 6,000 residents and local businesses.
Our current members don't have to worry about losing any services. We'll continue to provide them. However, we've had quite a few folks from outside Wilson County who have asked about possible partnerships with Wilson, just some ways to try to get that infrastructure to them, because we're the only ones in this part of the state who have an all-fiber network. That can't happen now, so we're pretty much landlocked within our county.
This was the fourth attempt by cable lobbyists to protect their turf by outlawing newer, faster, and cheaper networks.
There were a lot of folks calling this the Monopoly Protection Bill, because essentially what it's going to do, the effect is going to be that a lot of communities in North Carolina, in fact, most communities in North Carolina, will not have a choice now. They'll be stuck with cable if they get it, or DSL if they can get it, and some folks may be stuck with dial-up and satellite for the foreseeable future.
Governor Bev Perdue didn't veto the bill, but made it clear that she wasn't in favor of it. She asked the legislature to revisit the bill to give communities more options.
We do know that the cable companies' lobbyists are very close to a lot of the lawmakers in Raleigh, and they're not going to stop. I imagine that next year they'll come up with a bill that would try to go even deeper into local broadband networks in North Carolina, so I doubt this is over yet. I would be surprised if they'd be willing to give any ground.
Joel Kelsey, a policy analyst for Free Press, says that the North Carolina law is at odds with the federal stance on community broadband. A bipartisan coalition of senators introduced federal legislation to protect community broadband efforts a few years ago. And the National Broadband Plan calls for that protection as well.
I think it is time for the federal government to revisit this question and come in and protect the communities in North Carolina from this ill-founded and corporate-funded legislation, because we know one thing, and that's that the private companies aren't going to go there anytime soon.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today, joining us on the phones from New York City, is Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, author of many books, and a frequent commentator on television, and a weekly columnist now for the Washington Post blog, or online site. Katrina Vandenhoevel, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It's always a pleasure to have you. And we're talking now here at the end of May in 2011. And I don't think you've been on the show for a good year, year and a half. A lot has happened in the intervening time.
Really? Has a lot happened?
Yeah, I think so. I think
I think
one of those moments of history that things are really sort of hitting the fan or hitting the wall or whatever. They're hitting something. No one can complain that our times are boring. I think that's certainly a safe statement.
That is true.
And, you know, let's start with just the lay of the land domestically in the United States. And you, the Nation magazine, and you yourself cover Washington politics pretty much as well as anyone does. And, you know, what is your sense of the range of debate, the nature of our political leadership and going on in Congress in particular, and what interest that reflects, how good of a job they're doing?
The range of our debate in this country, Bob, is very narrow. I think there's some exciting debates going on, but within a narrow framework. I think we still have a kind of downsized politics of excluded alternatives. And I think part of that problem is something you study very closely, the media. I think, let me just give you one example of something that I think is hopeful, but is also undercovered, and something that the Nation covered, and then I think it moved into more mainstream places. That is, around the economy, the debate has been hugely frustratingly narrow and obsessed with deficits and debt. I think we got a democracy deficit in this country. I think it's insanity to introduce austerity into an ongoing recession. But within Congress, and this is something the Nation tries to cover, because I think until people know that there are alternatives inside D.C., they sort of give up. There's a progressive caucus. It's about 83 strong members of the House. It's not that powerful, but it is if we had a parliamentary system. This is the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And it put forth, in the middle of these budget debates, a people's budget. And it's a pretty good budget. It talks about, you know, what we've talked about, which is, you know, really protecting a pretty frayed social safety net in this country, promoting a progressive tax policy, ending these wars, which are not making us more secure, significant cuts to the Pentagon. And it actually generates a surplus by 2021. But what kind of coverage did that get in the mainstream press in the beginning days? A guy, Dana Milbank at the Washington Post, essentially called it a People's Republic of China document, thinking calling out the word people is too subversive. What I'm saying is, you know, there are possibilities in our system, but they don't get the attention they deserve, and they need to be supported from below. Because the other exciting thing in this last period, and I know you've covered it, Bob, is what happened in Madison, Wisconsin, the spirit of Madison. People in motion, people organizing, people protesting, people understanding that their lives are being attacked by those who want to roll back the 20th century, essentially. beginning with collective bargaining and moving on to other reforms which have made people's lives better in our society. So I think there's beginning of organizing and an awareness after 2.5 years, 2+ years of President Obama in the White House, that change is not going to come top-down, but it has, through history, as we've seen it, come from people organizing from, you know, I'm not sure we have movements now, but the beginning of movelets, of movements, beginning to understand that you need that independent organizing and movement outside of a Democratic Congress and White House to really begin to push.
You know, Katrina VandenHeuvel, a week before last, Congress voted, or the Senate voted, not to eliminate the loopholes for the big oil companies, which are basically, by all accounts, just gifts to these companies that are completely unnecessary and in view of the cutbacks elsewhere, arguably highly immoral. And the American people across the board, whatever their political views, oppose these loopholes, these gifts, these to the oil companies, these tax breaks. Yet they still the Senate voted to maintain them.
All right. And, so you had the entire Democratic caucus in the Senate, with the exception of three: Landrieu of Louisiana, Ben Nelson, and Begich of Alaska. And you know, this is where, Bob, the eternally important and unsexy topic of money in our politics comes back. This past week, The Nation lead edit was on "Let's End the Secret Money Arms Race." You know, you got a post-Citizens United landscape, that Supreme Court decision, shameful decision, saying corporations are people, allowing an unlimited flood of corporate treasury money into our political system. And if you put a money screen over these votes, you begin to see a little more clarity. But it is a what you pointed at the top of your good question is critical. There is a disconnect in this country between not just a daily poll, but surveys going back months about where the American people are, in the absence, by the way, of strong leadership. But where they are is what you said. They want to end the oil subsidies for these big oil companies. They want cuts in the defense budget before they want cuts in social safety programs. They don't want Medicare decimated. They want a stronger Medicare system. So on a lot of points, you see a disconnect between representation in Washington and where people are in this country. And I haven't even mentioned Afghanistan, where it's become, you know, the opposition to that war has become mainstream. I mean, it's not just Democrats, but independents, the so-called often always courted independents, and the Republicans are understanding this war is not one that is worth fighting. It's making us no more secure, and that we need to find a way out.
So, you know, Katrina VandenHeuvel, one of the things that's interesting about what you're just saying is that an issue after issue where there's overwhelming popular support, public opinion polls show conclusively that there's a certain policy that Americans like protecting Medicare or Social Security or getting out of Afghanistan, reducing military spending, reducing subsidies for oil companies, getting rid of low taxes for billionaires, all these things. And the numbers of support in public opinion polls generally are, you know, 60, 70, 80% in that range. They're overwhelming. Yet they have no factor, apparently, in how our politicians vote, as you point out, nor do they get a great deal of attention in our news media. Whereas it seems like on the other side of the coin, if suddenly like 50.0001% of Americans in a poll said they wanted to give subsidies to oil companies, we'd never hear the end of it. We have to honor the will of the people.
Listen, here's what's going on. You're the subject that you have studied for years so brilliantly is what, you know, is at the core of your question, media. The media collectively exercise perhaps the greatest single power there is in politics, the power to define reality, to determine which issues matter, which viewpoints deserve a hearing, right, to decide what the American people will know about the world around them. And I've always believed that part, you know, if people don't know, they may not care. They may not be willing to cross the Rubicon to a different kind of politics. If they don't care, they may not act. So what we try to do at The Nation, and we need to broaden this and coordinate so there is beginning, and there is. I mean, you were part of that important media reform Congress in Boston a couple months ago. There is the beginning of a progressive media, independent media, principled media infrastructure. And that is so critical because, as you know, Michael Copps of the FCC, someone you know well, such a good man, model of what a public servant should be, he's always said, and I'll paraphrase, you know, your first issue may be inequality, war, health care. Your second issue better be media, because that's how people are going to come to relate to that issue. And I would say, you know, one thing. I do think there's been some decent reporting on some core economic issues to the point where this past tax day, April 18th, a year ago I would have said that it was that day was defined by Tea Party memes. But this past tax day, I think you saw a lot more about corporate tax evasion. I think the New York Times big story on GE and tax evasion was an important one. Not a new issue. There's been a lot of reporting, but those tipping point moments are important. So that was important. And then you have, you know, Madison. You have a discussion about how this country is not bankrupt. The economic debates may be bankrupt, but this is a wealthy country. But how do we allocate revenues? And there are little movements like U.S. Uncut, a group that in some ways I have to say was inspired from the pages of The Nation by a piece about its sister group in the U.K., U.K. Mm-hmm. Uncut, and a movement that is saying, no, we are not going to see budgets balanced on the backs of working people, low-income, poor people. We want to see fair share, corporate taxation done so it brings revenues into our budgets, et cetera. So I think there's a shift. I think there's the beginning of a shift. So there's the disconnect, certainly inside the Beltway, certainly with elites and establishment politics, but there's also a different kind of politics that has a possibility of, you know, is beginning to emerge.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, talking to us from New York City. We're doing this interview approximately a week before going on air, so there are no questions today. It's a recorded program. Sit back, relax, and let us do the yakking today, if you will. And, you know, you talked about the economy, Katrina VandenHeuvel. The you know, it seems like in the pages of The Nation magazine and Paul Krugman's columns in The New York Times that when this economic crisis came down in 2007 and 2008, that there was already a pretty smart analysis, not only there, but there were other commentators like Dean Baker, who was our guest last week, that, you know, said this is a classic sort of moment in capitalism of a crisis where the solution is pretty obvious. You need to, one, regulate the financial system aggressively to prevent this from ever happening again, this sort of speculation. And two, you need a significant stimulus program to create jobs and to get people back to work. Otherwise, you're mired in a ditch you can't get out of. And it didn't really seem that controversial, sort of economics 101. It wasn't like something out of left field. Yet, as we look at the solution to the crisis, maddeningly enough for, I think, The Nation and Paul Krugman and others, the administration is sort of not going in that direction especially. What's your take on it? Am I getting it right, or am I overstating the situation?
No, you're right. I think this is one of the great tragedies of this period because, you know the history, Bob. There are very few moments in history which provide an opening for major structural reform. Yet there are very few times in our history where you have had more obstacles to structural reform. And I'm not excusing or apologizing for an administration or failures of leadership or failures to demand more of banks. But you have the welter of lobbyists and of money that did not allow a true restructuring of a system which desperately needs it. I mean, a system, this is not radical. We'll call it what you will, but there were good economists. You mentioned, you know, Krugman. But you've had Dean Baker on your program, Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, a slew of them who understood that there was an importance in restructuring these banks. Call it what you will, nationalization may scare folks, but you needed to restructure and find ways to ensure that these masters of the universe, that the economy serve, the real economy serve people and not vice versa. Today we sit here, the top six banks are probably 30% bigger than before the crisis. These leverage margins have been, you know, amped up again. There is no systemic reform. You do have a Dodd-Frank bill, which is a reform, but not commensurate with the crisis or the scale of the problems going forward. And I think here it is a different moment than the Great Depression. President Obama came in at a different period than Franklin Roosevelt came in. And also, I think in an ironic way, the great reforms of the New Deal, though some have been rolled back, like Glass-Steagall, which meant a division between kind of the banking and investment wings of these big banks, but the retail and investment. But the buffers that the New Deal provided, the FDIC, Social Security, others didn't take this country into the full abyss. Then, this is the great tragedy, the recovery program. You know, we say it wasn't big enough and it was larded with tax cuts for political compromise reasons. To be fair, you know, $700 billion in that program seems pretty big, but in the culture, political economy we live in now, it doesn't seem that big. But on the other hand, it was sold as recovery, badly sold, got conflated in millions of people's minds with the bailout of the banks.
Mm-hmm.
I think in many ways that led to the rise of the Tea Party, a right-wing populism. But that recovery plan...
This is WILL, Illinois Public Media. The National Weather Service in Chicago has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for a large portion of northeastern Illinois until 2 o'clock this afternoon. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, Ford County is included in the warned area. In addition, a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for much of northern Illinois until 4 o'clock this afternoon, and that watch includes Ford County.
Politically, I think it's going to be difficult heading into 2012, even though on the other side, we're witnessing, I think, not only wrong, but very cruel policies put forth by these Republicans. But it's tough.
So do you think that had President Obama come out of the gates similar to FDR in March 1933 and had a fireside chat, so to speak, on YouTube with the American people, said, listen, the economy, this is why it's in trouble. We're in a rare moment. We have to take dramatic steps. Do you think you could have mobilized support for a much more dramatic, sweeping reform? Or do you think it would have been impossible, no matter what?
I think so, but here's what happens. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, different country. You got a more militant labor movement. What he also had, Roosevelt had, was what President Obama kind of promised us. And by the way, on many issues, President Obama has kept true to his promises. I mean, if you looked at his language during the campaign, he did talk about Afghanistan as the good war, though the surge was, and he talked about wanting to bring country together, conciliatory politics. But he didn't, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a true team of rivals, a promise Obama made to this country that he would bring in a team of rivals. Now, someone said to me the other day, well, he must have thought he did that with bringing in Hillary Clinton. But I always took it to mean in that economic team, which was so critical, you would see a Robert Reich or a Stiglitz, even a Paul Volcker, who got marginalized because he was a little more willing to confront the banks. Instead, you had Geithner. Timothy Geithner had his paws all over the bailout, which has become such a rightly radioactive, polarizing politics. You have Larry Summers. I mean, these are people who are essentially, how do they construct a reform if they are complicit in what we're witnessing as reasons for the financial crisis? So that, at the outset, was kind of like original sin. To have that team made it very difficult for a president who didn't have his own farm team, his own bench, to move beyond the limits of his politics. And then, on a whole slew of issues, particularly health care, to demobilize those in the base, the campaign who had supported you, the millions of people in this country who could have been, even if you're a pragmatic president, to have that wind at your back, millions of people to confront the establishment power, the moneyed forces, all of those who have no interest in any kind of reform. And that, it was a lost opportunity because there was panic, as you know, Bob, among these banks. There was a possibility of at least demanding that they participate in the rebuilding of this economy. Instead, they come off like, we've been threatened, we're, being attacked, and now they're holier than thou and they're bigger than thou.
Yeah, wasn't it, Katrina VandenHeuvel, Business Week or The Economist had the cover story, in the depths of the crisis, we are all socialists now, or Newsweek, one of the great Newsweek.
It was Newsweek, absolutely. There was the possibility of the beginning, of thinking about a different kind of economy. An economy, and Paul Krugman had the great expression, kind of plain vanilla, boring. Because what we've seen over these last 30, 40 years is the hyper-financialization of an economy, the Wall Streetization, the consolidation. You've tracked that in the media, but certainly in the financial sector, you have 5-6 massive, huge, multinational global banks, and it's just not an economy that is serving the needs of millions of people. It is serving the derivatives market. It is serving securitized mortgage markets. The good news, and here's state by state, if I could just say for a moment, where I'm sitting in New York, the Attorney General here, Eric Schneiderman, is a very interesting figure who has just really taken on three big banks in this city and is going to push them hard on mortgage securitization and looking into the fraud that may have been committed on behalf of consumers, on behalf of people. So you've seen, you know, different little ripples and eruptions around the kind of weakness of the major piece of legislation which arose from the crisis. And I think, not me, but people in the financial sector and people I don't admire, but Carl Icahn, Milken, out of this big sort of notorious Milken conference the other day, he was the father of junk bonds in the 80s. They're talking about watch out for another financial crisis in the next few years because we just haven't seen sufficient restructuring of a sector that is very possibly lurch back into some kind of bubble crisis.
Well, as I understand it, the issues always, when they get this large, the saying too big to fail, but you get what economists call a moral hazard in which these guys know they can take crazy chances because if everything goes wrong, the government has to bail them out or they can take the entire global economy and put it at the bottom of the ocean.
Yep. And so
it's sort of a no-lose proposition. And they certainly, the immediate record for them is they did it in 2007, 2008, and they came out riding high. So why not play this game?
Why not? Exactly.
Until they stop, you keep running, you'll make a few billion dollars a year, personally, not to mention your firm.
We're seeing, as I said, we're seeing sort of things on the edges, the corporate tax evasion front. But, you know, even there inside Washington, crazily, a debate is more about lowering the corporate tax rate and then closing loopholes, as opposed to keeping the corporate tax rate right where it is and closing loopholes. It's lubricated politics. I mean, it's not just the money, but it's a big piece of it. It's the money that these operations have, 7-8 lobbyists to each representative, and they are giving sacks of money to political forces that lead to a kind of politics that is much more about self-preservation, status quo, than reform.
Our guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Please don't call in today. We recorded this program roughly a week before going on air with it, so let Katrina Vandenhoevel and me do the yakking today. Katrina, we've been talking about an issue I know that is absolutely central to the pages of The Nation, to your readership, your constituency, and it's an issue I confess that I talk about incessantly with my friends, including my dear friend John Nichols, who writes for The Nation, which is the relationship of the Democratic Party to its voting base and the tensions there and the nature of it. And Glenn Greenwald, who you're familiar with.
Absolutely.
And Glenn has a line he's used many times, which is that the Republican Party fears its base and the Democratic Party hates its base. And that his example for this was how comfortable the White House has been periodically chewing out its voting base, progressives, and their demands as being disloyal to the Obama administration when they're critical of them, but showing very little interest in attacking their political enemies with the same enthusiasm or willingness.
Yeah.
And, this has been a core tension.
I know, a core tension. It's true. I wrote a tough column in the Washington Post a few months ago. I did not give it the headline of failed presidency. The Washington Post editors did, but it was ticking off. It was ticking off a lot of the disappointments.
Yeah.
Not just progressives, but people across the board have had with this administration. But focusing on the left and progressives, and I never think anything is targeted at me. I'm a modest person, but the next day President Obama gave a press conference and lashed out at sanctimonious progressives. Now.
I think it was you. I can promise you that.
I mean, it was a lead op-ed in the Washington Post. But here's the thing. I mean, President Obama might well, and John Nichols and I have talked about this, might well study the history of relations between Democratic administrations and the base, because those who have been successful, and I hate to keep referring to Roosevelt, but you learn how to work with that base. You don't diss it. You don't dismiss it. You find ways to have it push you, to move you beyond the limits of your own politics. I don't know. I think Glenn Greenwald is brilliant in so many ways, a courageous voice. I don't know if the Democratic Party, what did he say, hates its base?
Yeah.
I think it's often contemptuous of the base. It's not fearful of the base. That is partly our fault. I think we could do more. I think there's some work underway to find ways, certainly in this next period, to take on those very centrist corporate Democrats, to identify them, to recruit alternatives to them. But, you know, again, not to be too structural, but, you know, we are a poor country in many ways because we have two main parties. So the ability to have flanks and factions and parliamentary parties is not ours. But it is the case within the Democratic Party that it is a big umbrella, so that you do have the more progressive Democrats, not as powerful as the pro-corporate centrist Democrats. So this, you know, that's an ongoing struggle. And I think we need inside-outside politics done more savvily. We need ongoing mobilization. And we do need to put some fear into the spines of some of these Democrats. Now, I have not seen this debate erupt yet. John Nicholson, again, and I have talked about bringing this into the pages of The Nation. We've seen other debates, for example, you know, Cornel West, Al Sharpton, The Nation's Melissa Harris-Perry arguing about President Obama's politics as mm-hmm. a kind of proxy for the Democratic Party politics.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue of a primary. Primaries, presidential primaries, have often been used to cast some fear into the more centrist corporate Democrats. I think this year is one, I'm sorry, the next 2012 is not the year to do a primary. I think it is one to really focus on the Congress and to build a field team and to look toward 2016 to really try and find a progressive candidate or two who will respect the base, who will understand, as they say in Texas, you know, the dance with those that brung you, because we haven't seen enough of that.
You know, the great dilemma of American politics for most of my adult lifetime, and I suspect since you're younger than I am, all of yours, has been this liberals, progressives, the left, however one wants to define it. And it's a very broad group, as I think you know better than anyone editing The Nation, that they've had the relationship with the Democratic Party has always been sort of tenuous in
yeah.
the sense that most Americans don't realize that historically the Democratic Party wasn't the progressive or liberal party. It really wasn't until the New Deal that relationship was cemented. And it's no reason to think that it has to be a permanent relationship per se. It is mostly by default because of what's happened in the Republican Party. And, you know, I think what we've seen is that progressives and liberals and certainly the readers of The Nation would qualify in this score, have worked very hard to try to make the Democratic Party more progressive and more in tune with the needs of its voting base, workers, people of color, women,
yep.
environmentalists.
Yep.
And it's been, if we look at the picture from 1975 to 2011, it hasn't been a very pretty picture. You know, it seems like the Democratic Party is further from shore rather than closer, despite all the efforts. And the only thing that puts it in context that makes it sort of palatable, I guess, is the Republican, it makes it possible, it's a better way to put it, is the Republican Party's gotten that much more right-wing than it ever was in the 1970s.
Yeah, no, they've lost. I mean, not only is it an extremist party losing, with a very few exceptions, any tinge of moderate Republicanism, it's become a, you know, they're strands of bigotry, racism. But, you know, I think you see also... you know, you see a shifting demographic in this country, Bob, to think again sort of out a decade, two decades, which will be very interesting to watch because the Latino population of this country is growing exponentially. Many states are now majority-minority. Where that will take our politics. There is a view that young people are more tolerant. I think that's right. I think there's a strong strand of libertarianism among young people and how that plays out in economic debates. I think there needs to be, for the moment, not maybe national, though the Progressive Caucus I come back to is something that is beginning to go out into the country. Progressive Caucus people are going to do hearings in 17 states this summer, meeting with citizens, hearings on joblessness, on the economy. But in my state, New York State, you have a Working Families Party, which works with this fusion electoral reform, so it cross-endorses candidates. It has worked to make the Democratic Party more progressive, more in tune with a populism, and done so fairly well in New York City. Governor Cuomo is very problematic, and I think that is open to question where that heads, and has exposed, I think, the limits of the Working Families Party strategy. But to build some of those Working Families Party possibilities, even in states without this fusion reform, which I think is only in seven states, is important. And to build those coalitions, maybe around issues to begin with, Bob, and drive those into the Democratic Party, will, in the absence of a multi-party system, which many people have been working on reforms to build that out over these last decades, is maybe the way to go. You know, a young intern at our editorial meeting yesterday talked about Nader, and, you know, understood the limits of certainly his second run, but also wondered why there wasn't more third-party, four-party action in this country. You know, and that's something we should think hard about because, as you put it, and I'm not that young, but the great dilemma is not only the relationship of left liberal progressives to the Democratic Party, but it's how you open up a debate, and so much of that opening up has to do with electoral possibilities. My last point, though, is, you know, the Democratic Party, as you know, so often there has been a division between those who care deeply about social issues and those who are more focused on the economic populist piece, and I think Clinton effectively co-opted the party. Not, you know, it's not the worst thing, but it really became a kind of socially tolerant party, but with real disregard for the more important economic populist issues, very sort of pro-corporate. And how we break that pro-corporate grip is a battle of our time, not just in the Democratic Party, but in our politics.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, our guest on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. A recorded show. Please just sit back, relax, let us do the talking. Katrina, I want to go on to foreign policy for most of the rest of the show, but I have one last question on this.
Please.
Because it's something that's breaking across the country in state after state, which is, you know, as you just pointed out, you know, you look at the demographics of this country, you look at the exit polling from the 2008 election, you look at the overwhelming support, I think unprecedented, that the Democrats and Barack Obama got in 2008 from voters under the age of 30 and from new voters. And everything, I think, in political science pointed to the fact that we're seeing a major shift politically in this country toward the Democratic Party and away from the Republicans. Now, that seems there's been a major bump in the road for a variety of reasons, some of which we've probably alluded to already. But my question is that the Republican Party, to some extent, as I can see it, has sort of acknowledged this is taking place. And their way of combating it is not to shift their policies, but rather, in many states in this country, they're going dramatic efforts to make it far more difficult for people to vote.
Absolutely. I think this is under the radar. It should not be. But in state after state, and for example, take Wisconsin. Scott Walker's attack on collective bargaining, on labor, on regulation got a lot of attention. But he is also attacking the right to vote. They're doing it in these insidious ways about voter fraud, and you need a driver's license, an ID. And they know perfectly well the coded politics there is that people of color, younger people, older progressive people, you know, don't have as much access to these documents. So one thing I think is interesting to watch, and I think more will come out in this next period, is a lot of attention to, your listeners probably have heard of the Koch brothers, the big billionaires.
Yes, they certainly have.
Billionaires, corporate funding, all kinds of the pro-corporate politics. But, you know, the Koch brothers are a face on an infrastructure that has deep roots in these states called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. ALEC is in the business of doing model legislation for legislators in states, and we're seeing that play out as you watch a number of states, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Indiana, Florida, for example, really doing some similar ramrodding through of pretty ugly legislation, a lot of it designed, to come back to your question, to limit, curtail, suppress democracy. So I think this is something to watch because in addition to the money, I think the Republican Party is not a foolish party, maybe a cruel party, but it knows what it's doing in trying to suppress voting. And
coordinate
that with the money piece.
This is going to be a big, big political story in 2012 and going forward until it's resolved for the better.
Instead, you know, what we should be fighting for, and I think you do. This is where, by the way, the Democrats may not put enough spine muscle behind it. But, you know, I mentioned this lead edit we did in The Nation about the secret money arms race. You know, they're going to, too many Democrats are now going to, because they don't want to have their hand tied behind their back in 2012, they're going to engage in the money arms race. Mm-hmm. But at least, you know, you have a lot of support for things like Fair Elections Now Act, Disclose Act.
This is WILL, Illinois Public Media. The National Weather Service in Chicago has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for a large portion of northeastern Illinois until 2 o'clock this afternoon. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, Ford County is included in the warned area. However, radar indicates that the severe weather has moved off to the east. Meanwhile, a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for a large portion of northern Illinois, including Ford County, in the WILL severe weather coverage area, and that watch is posted until 4 p.m. this afternoon.
So please don't call in. Let us do the yakking. Katrina Vandenhoevel, you've written a lot, talked a lot about U.S. foreign policy. A few weeks ago now, the United States assassinated bin Laden and sort of marked the initial purpose of the war on terror was to get bin Laden. That's what we were told on September 12th and 13th and 14th. And, you know, where are we now, almost 10 years after the 9/11 attacks? And what do you think the United States should be doing in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Big questions. So to begin, I thought, you know, that night Osama bin Laden was announced dead. It seems so off to see these sort of triumphalist celebrations in the streets, because to me it was a moment for sort of sober reckoning and reflection on the costs of these last 10 years. I begin with the fact that, you know, to have declared this a war against terror, put this country on a war footing, when effective battle against terrorism really requires policing, legal, smart intelligence, tough diplomacy. And that, you know, what we have seen in so many ways is that our response to terrorism has undermined the very values that define America, or we believe define America. So I think we certainly mark an end to a chapter with Osama bin Laden's death, but we now need to turn to how we end the war in Afghanistan, which I mentioned earlier. You know, it's not only now opposition been mainstreamed to that war, but, you know, it's, quote, the good war that has gone bad. But we should not be occupying with vast land armies this country. There are political, moral, strategic, tactical mistakes in that, and we must find a way to, you know, reframe America's role in the world, and that's where it extends also into, I can't call it the Arab Spring, though it's extraordinary to see, you know, what happened in Egypt and Tunisia, Arab uprisings. There's been too much brutality in that part of the world, but, you know, as President Obama's speech of a week or so ago spoke of, this is it's a moment to rethink America's support for autocratic governments and repressive military and security apparatuses, and find a way, in not just words. The words are pretty good. Obama's speech was pretty good in the first part about trying to realign our values with people's uprisings in that part of the world, but and also some of the economic debt relief, but to really rethink America's role in the world and its footprint, and find ways to develop a new national security.
Yeah, for my daughters, who are both, well, one's in her early 20s now, the other's a high school sophomore, I mean, they've always known the United States sort of being at war. It's like Oceania versus Eurasia. Like a permanent part of their lives that the United States is always at war with someone. And like in Eurasia versus Oceania, it's almost unclear who exactly we're fighting or why. There's no understanding whatsoever what's going on here. It's just permanent war.
No, it's very troubling. I mean, it's not. It's a sense, and this is again why I come back. It's not abstract that the danger of not only this decision to put the United States on a war footing after 9/11, the Bush administration, but with complicity by Congress, And this authorization for use of military force, let's not forget that, which was passed immediately after 9/11, essentially was an authorization for a kind of endless war. I noticed a few weeks ago that Republicans are trying to deepen and expand that authorization. Instead of saying, as I said earlier, let us have a sober reckoning of where we've been and let us step back and rethink America's role in the world. What's interesting in our cover story in The Nation next week is a story about Walter Jones. You may recall he's an interesting microcosm of these years because he was the man who decided to rename French fries Freedom Fries because of the French opposition to war in Iraq.
Yeah.
But he is also from the district in North Carolina where Camp Lejeune is, and he went during Iraq to so many funerals for service people. And because he's a religious man, his conscience could no longer square what he was hearing in Congress, the intelligence he saw, the purposes of these wars, with the devastation in his community. So he has emerged as an important anti-war voice, joining with someone your listeners should know, Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, good man, who has sponsored various resolutions for a expeditious withdrawal from Afghanistan. But there is a little movelet inside the Republican Party. You know, people we may not agree with on most, like Ron Paul, also Walter Jones. There's a guy out of Utah, a Tea Party guy. But there's a beginning on that side of what I would call neo-Taftian, in tradition of Robert Taft isolationism, to say, hey, what are we doing? But if you can build that coalition, I do think it's an opportunity to rethink the very dangerous endless war syndrome this country could go through, and the collateral damage that has brought, not only the terrible cost, literal cost, the lives lost, the psychic costs, the opportunity costs. I mean, so I think there's an opening, and that is you know, now there's an enormous, it's no longer even what Eisenhower spoke of in his farewell address. I mean, the military-industrial complex has now been larded with, you know, the contractors. Jeremy Scahill here has done groundbreaking work on Blackwater. We've seen Eric Prince now, I guess he's in Dubai, corrupting that country at its Emirates desires. But it's really become an enormous apparatus that needs to be scrutinized and moved.
Let me interrupt you on this point, Katrina, to rephrase it and ask you a direct question about it, because I think you hit the nail, a really interesting nail, at least in the head, which is that as Eisenhower feared in his famous farewell address in 1960 or 61, that, you know, we now have huge industries that depend upon our being at war or spending lots of money to prepare for war, which leads to war. And they have spectacular influence over our government. I mean, they're almost unopposed in the corridors of power.
Well, here's where, I mean, one project I'm working on with a good person you probably know, Robert Pollan, good economist.
Sure, know him well.
Robert Pollan did a terrific piece for this place a year or so ago called The Wages of Peace. But he and I, along with the Institute for Policy Studies, are trying to put together a project which carries on the work of someone your listeners should Google if they don't know him, Seymour Melman. Seymour Melman, at the end of the Cold War, had this whole idea of conversion. How do we move from war footing to an economy where there is productive investment in what makes this country truly secure? As we see the openings for the rethinking of a defense budget, which is bloated, out of control, way beyond anything going on in the rest of the world, we're going to also need to do some hard presentation of facts and research to show that there are jobs available in other sectors that are more productive. Because at a minimal level, I know you're talking about the huge infrastructure of lobbyists, contractors, et cetera, but, you know, the old story is, these arms programs, the defense budget, is a jobs program. We need to reframe that. Is it tough? But I think there's not a lot of hunger in this country, it seems to me, right now, post-Bush, even into the Obama period, for this kind of messianic foreign policy. I think there's, you know, an interest in being secure with a smaller U.S. footprint, quote, footprint, and maybe not isolationism, but certainly not this, you know, 700 bases strung around the world. That's low-hanging fruit, by the way, and other things like that.
You know, Katrina, I don't know if you recall or saw Oliver Stone did a documentary on Latin America called, I believe, South of the Border, that Mark Weisbrot and Tariq Ali wrote the teleplay or screenplay for, the script. And one of the episodes in it was that they were interviewing the president of Argentina.
Uh-huh.
the former president of Argentina, and he recounted a story discussion he had with George Bush when George W. Bush was president in 2001, and when Argentina's economy collapsed.
Yes.
And he said to George W. Bush, "I've got to take these dramatic steps. I can't be linked to the dollar. I've got to renounce our debt, our international debt, or else my economy's in collapse." And George W. Bush said to him, "Well, you know what we do in America when our economy gets in a slump? We just increase military spending."
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, Argentina did the right thing. Mark Weisbrot has a good piece in our last issue, not about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, but about the role of the IMF in the world economy and what we need to think about in terms of Greece, Spain, Portugal. And he cites the Argentinian example of a smart move, even though it was loathed at the time by the powers that be, but to de-link. But, Oliver Stone, by the way, your listeners should know, is about to, I've seen the first three parts, but he is doing a 12-part series on the untold history of the United States, beginning just before World War II, but moving into the Cold War, into the emergence of America as an empire. I think it'll be an interesting, it's much different than that documentary you mentioned, because he, Oliver Stone, appears for 1 or 2 minutes, and it's a lot of footage. There are no talking heads, but it's truly quite spectacular. Anyway, it's the defense budget has, I think, constricted and constrained the possibilities of this country. And if we're trying to find money, we need to rethink the priorities of that budget. But also, we do need to find ways to create jobs. The creation of jobs is, one of the most important things. I mean, I think it's probably the joblessness, corruption, inequality, or the sort of it's the trifecta that is a universal problem, and each country, in many ways, countries working together need to find ways to address it. And China, I think, is an interesting moment because its economy is facing a lot of wildcat strikes. We don't even see much of it, the tip of the iceberg, Shanghai trucker strike a few months ago, but the government is beginning to put money into workers' pockets, which means that the wage rates are certainly still too low, but are going to be driven up, and that will have an impact on a global economy that has been, until now, a race to the bottom. That may move to Africa, these extractive and other things, but it's going to be an interesting period.
And I think, just to put a final point on that, the Obama administration, the Democrats in Congress, have not seemingly put a super heavy emphasis on job creation.
You're being kind. I mean, I think it's shameful. I think that you have the powers that be are not tackling the jobs crisis, and then the prioritization of a deficit debt crisis again is the inside the Beltway establishment debate, and it is reflected and refracted back onto the establishment. The media does not help. The media buys in for the most part into this the deficit debt crisis obsession. But it is also the money. The money is not people's money for the most part. It is corporate money coming into a system, and corporate money is not that interested in first and foremost job creation. We see that on corporations sitting on some $2 trillion and moaning about uncertainty in the economy. Give me a break.
Our guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left, Katrina, and that you are one of the few guests I ever have who's, is an expert on the former Soviet Union and Russia and can speak with authority about developments there. And I could do a whole show with you on this, and I hope sometime we can, because I'm endlessly fascinated by what's going on in Eastern Europe today, and I think it's largely unknown to Americans except lame sound bites that are done by powerful interests here for one reason or another. And the question I have for you is, I was reading Naomi Klein's book, mm-hmm. Disaster Capitalism, mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, and one of the chapters in it, it's a very moving chapter, it was very emotional to read, describes how in Poland the solidarity movement of Lech Walesa and the workers in Gdansk, how democratic they were. Their aspirations were not to have a capitalist society, but to democratize their economy. And that this was really a very strong and powerful movement. And she chronicles how in just a brief window of time, no more than a year or two, maybe three at the outside, this movement was completely transformed almost into its opposite. It became a neoliberal movement for Milton Friedman as the patron saint. And I was wondering as I read that, I want your comments on that in a second, but first, I was wondering as I read that, do you think the history of Eastern Europe today, across the board, all the former Warsaw Pact nations, including Russia, had the collapse of communism occurred 15 years earlier, say, that they might have had a very different history, that just that it's almost a coincidence of history that the collapse of communism occurred at possibly the worst moment in the 20th century for them to actually transition to a more democratic, humane society?
Yes, but I do think that you're seeing you've seen the backlash against neoliberalism in those economies, though they haven't, the global context is so difficult. I think you're seeing, I can't speak as much for Central Europe or Eastern Europe, but in Russia, you're seeing the backlash against the looting of the state, the oligarchical privatization. There is a new class of oligarchs. But, President Medvedev and Putin, though they have different concepts of the modernization of their economy, you've seen a reintroduction of kind of a strong state role in that economy. And I think you're right that these economies came into the world out of the communist shell at a terrible time when neoliberalism was riding high, not for long, and they bought into that. But the impoverishment, certainly in Russia, of massive numbers of people has led to a fierce backlash, and there is not much affection for the Western role anymore. Medvedev occasionally makes little punts at free market, this and that, but there's a full awareness that the state has to play a role. I just assigned a piece on Cuba, Bob, if I might add, because
please
I think there's a woman who's worked at NACLA for a long time, but I think there is a misconception that what we're witnessing in Cuba is a capitulation to capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It is more along the spectrum of that there have always been different models of socialism. I think back to Russia in the 20s where you had new economic policy, where you did have a small market sector and a state doing the commanding heights quote of the economy. And I think in Cuba, it's a very difficult global economy, different moment, though it has good ties in the region, Latin America being so vibrant in so many ways, movement-wise, economics, that it'll be interesting to watch how the reforms in Cuba move. But to describe it as sort of capitalist is just off and shows the limits of a media, mainstream media, which also just kind of categorizes what went on in Eastern Europe or Russia as neoliberal capitalism. It was more complex. But I think Russia's in a very difficult position, and I think, readers might come to The Nation in a week or two. My husband has a big piece, Stephen Cohen, on where the reset is between the United States and Russia and what's going on inside Russia as it heads into its own presidential elections in 2012.
Yeah, I will definitely look for that piece. And I'm glad you ended on that note, because tell our listeners, if you would, those maybe not familiar with The Nation or only loosely familiar, where they can learn more about it and what they'd find if they were to subscribe.
I would tell your readers to begin by coming to thenation.com and check out, how you might subscribe. You can subscribe digitally as well as print. But The Nation is America's most widely read, oldest continuously published weekly magazine, and now moving around on different platforms, on the web, on your Kindle, on your iPad. But it is always trying to speak truth to power and raising tough questions. And in my mind, always trying to lay out what alternatives are to the world as we live in it and to what a world more just, peaceful might be.
Katrina VandenHool, editor and publisher of The Nation, thank you so much for taking time out of your extraordinarily busy schedule
to
spend an hour with us.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
All right. And listeners, thank you all very much for staying tuned. I'll be back in 167 hours. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is WILL and WILL-FM and HD Urbana. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Ford County in east central Illinois until 4 p.m. It's 2 o'clock central time. Thanks for listening to WILL, Illinois Public Media.
And 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.